Mr. Rothbard's contributions to creating a libertarian society, I think, are incalculable. His works such as Man, Economy, and State, its sequels, Power and Market, Government and Economy, many of his writings on economics and in other areas have been brilliant and have provided very important contributions and have helped pave the way for a great many people to truly understand some of the issues in the libertarian society. I consider the conference very fortunate to be able to have Mr. Rothbard here in attendance. Mr. Rothbard is also the editor of the Libertarian Forum, one of the more stimulating and controversial publications in the libertarian movement. The topic of his speech for today's session is going to be Chicago economics versus Austrian economics. The Chicago economics, most prominently known by Milton Friedman, Austrian economics, most prominently known by von Mises. At this point, I'd like to turn the floor over to Mr. Rothbard. Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to once again attend the Libertarian Conference and to have so many people turn out for it. I'm also in a tough spot here in a sense, personally, because I'm itching to get into the previous debate. But I was obviously the climactic point of the conference, but I will refrain. Maybe I can sneak something in the course of an attack on the Chicago school. The basic problem, I think, the fundamental basic problem with Chicago, well, first place, if you ask the average person, the average intellectual or reader of Time magazine or whatever, about free market economics, if he knows anything about it at all, he'll identify it with Milton Friedman or other Chicago economists. So they have sort of preempted the field of free market economics in this country. One way they're able to do this, they have a very strong sectarian sense, which I don't blame them for particularly, but they have it. And so that they push each other into positions and get each other jobs, that sort of thing. So they have a strong sense of intra-Chicago solidarity. The basic problem, I think, from the point of view of true freedom, liberty, and justice about the Chicago school, well, there are a couple of basic problems. One basic problem is their attitude toward the state. They regard the state as equivalent. As an equivalent arm of social action. In other words, you've got the market out here, you've got voluntary clubs out there, and you've got the state over here, and they're all about the same. There's no moral distinction, no logical distinction between the two or three of them. So that the Chicagoite is never against government action because they're moral or criminal or whatever. He considers it as another social tool, the government. Well, we look at each situation ad hoc. Should the government build steel plants? Well, we look at the situation, we examine the statistical correlations, etc. And we usually wind up with a conclusion that they shouldn't because it's less efficient than the market doing. But you'll never know from one ad hoc problem to the next what the Chicagoite is going to come up with, because each area, each field is a separate, distinct field for investigation. The Chicago Act has no general theory attacking the state or considering the state is even somehow different in any way from a private action. The corollary to this is the fact that Chicago whites have no theory of justice in property rights. In other words, they talk a lot about private property, at least in the last few years. But their view of private property is purely instrumental. In other words, government decides who should get this property. Better But when they arrive at it from the point of view of social efficiency, in quotes, I personally don't think there is such a concept of social efficiency. But they arrive at it from the point of view of social efficiency. They say, well, it looks like it's more efficient to assign property rights in this area than to have it communally owned. And it doesn't make any difference who we assign it to, because it all works out the same. It all comes out the same in the wash. A famous example of this is the problem of air pollution. For example, the railroad locomotive is chugging down the road and smoke is coming out of the smokestack and blighting the orchards of the neighboring farmers. And the question is, who should pay who? Who owns the property? Should the railroads have to compensate the farmers for the damage? Or should the farmers have to beg the railroads to stop by paying them off, paying the railroads to put in a smokeless smokestack? And according to the Chicago Life, it doesn't make any, they like to see either one done. It doesn't make any difference whatsoever which one is done. My point of view, I think the Austrian point of view in general as well, is it doesn't make a difference. It's a fundamental moral question, who gets the property. From my point of view, the farmers own the property, they own the orchards, and the railroad should be stopped or forced to pay damages or whatever for any invasion of that property. And so in other words, what happens is that the Chicago School, starting off the idea of completely value-free economics, economics are supposedly shorn of any kind of moral or ethical position, why not, however, taking all sorts of moral, political positions, all sorts of, making all sorts of political statements, presumably also value-free. In other words, you have this leap from supposedly value-free science to a supposedly value-free politics, which I don't think can exist. And it's done on various bases. One, as I say, the state is some sort of a neutral tool. And two, it's the concept of so-called social efficiency in some way. It's more efficient to have a government do this such and such, or to have private do such and such. From my point of view, if they really want to be value-free, then they should make no statements about politics at all. They should shut up about politics. But of course, they don't. Particularly glaring example of this is the question of taxes, which of course is a key element in government operation. I have to say here, for my fellow Austrians, the Austrians have been very weak on tax theory also. They really have very little to say about theory of taxes. And as a matter of fact, this is true for limited government types in general, I must say. If a limited government person favors taxes, which most of them do, I'm exempting objectivists in this discussion, but most limited government people, of course, favor taxes. Another question is, how do you raise the taxes, and which taxes, and so forth and so on. And what are the justifications for this or that? And it gets pretty dicey. Well, usually the Austrian position on taxes, they like to have a lower tax structure as possible, which I go along with. And two, that it should not be progressive. The income taxes should not be progressive, for example. And three, they should somehow be neutral with respect to the market, which is, of course, really impossible. But this is just about as far as Austrians will go in a tax theory. But at least most Austrians aren't really enamored of taxes. They don't consider taxes somehow a lovable instrument. Whereas Chicagoites really do, once they get around to the doctrine that taxes are really more efficient in this particular area. So if you turn to the Chicago writings on taxation, there's a big yen for taxes in many ways. I remember a few years ago, there was a meeting of the Mount Pelerin Society, which is a group of international free market, semi-free market, and one-tenth free market economists, and social philosophers, and journalists, and businessmen. And they gather every year at a pleasant summer resort. And one year, three Chicagoans zeroed in on Belgium or wherever the meeting was held. And three of them had independently arrived with this magnificent theory of a new kind of tax. I don't know if they've ever published this, but at any rate, they arrived at this, and it was all great minds, working independently on a problem, or arrived at the same solution. They arrived at this, and the tax went as follows. And this, I think, is sort of indicative of the Chicagoite mentality and Chicagoite attitude toward property in general. It went something like this. Here's what we do. We get everybody to assess his own property. You know, in other words, I have a set of books, or you have a house, or a factory, or whatever it is. Each guy puts on his own assessment. Well, that's pretty good, you know, because if each guy is allowed to put his own assessment down, then any kind of Gestapo investigation, the usual first temptation put out, you know, valuation of something like half a penny. And you pay your rate on it. Ah, but there's a clinker here, which Chicago people worked out. If you are forced by the government to sell this particular property to anybody who comes along at that rate. So they really lapped this up. They really thought this was somehow the answer to the tax question. See, it's more efficient. You don't have to have a big arm of assessors investigating what your property really is. You let the guy assess it himself, and then whatever schmo down the block comes along and says, okay, you say your house is worth half a cent, here's a half a penny, and you're forced to sell it to him. Is that right? And at this meeting, Paul Friedrich Hayek, a distinguished free market Austrian economist, was very concerned about this. Particularly, he has a distinguished book collection, and he said, "Well, my God, this means that if I value a set of the books, my books, at the going price, let's say, this means that I would be forced to sell it to anybody. And this means, of course, if I value the books very highly, I have to put an enormous assessment on it." Say, in other words, especially if you know that some people are out to get you, they want to destroy your books. You have to put an assessment of $10 billion in your book collection, which means you have to pay $100,000 a year or whatever the property tax will be, which you might not have. So of course, the Chicago entity, and what about my books? Hayek said, and the answer, of course, the Chicago answer was, a tough on your books. I think this really sums up the Chicago position on taxes. It's a position of brutal indifference to genuine property right and a desire to clean up the state. In other words, make the state as efficient as possible. See, the thing is, the Chicago people look, for example, in the notorious Friedman negative income tax, which I don't know if I want to go into it like, but at any rate, Friedman looks around at the welfare system. It's a big mess, right? No question about that. I think anybody would argue about this. Every city, every state, every region has its own crazy system, et cetera, et cetera. And it's inefficient, and there are all sorts of bureaucrats who get papers lost and things of that sort. It's a lot of red tape to get into it. So the theory is, you make it more efficient. Make the system more efficient, you have a guaranteed minimum income is what it amounts to. And you pay the guy through the income tax form. So he sends in, I'm simplifying this, of course, a great deal, but in essence, this is what it is. If the minimum is set at $2,000 a year, if your income happens to be $500 a year, you submit your form to the IRS, and you get back $1,500. Now, of course, FEMA will make certain adjustments to try to weaken some of the disincentive effect, which is pretty obvious in this thing. But basically, this is what happens. So in other words, everybody gets that automatic claim on production. Instead of having to shuffle through a large welfare bureaucracy and get lost in the shuffle and get stepped on by arrogant welfare workers and that sort of thing, you simply submit your form and you get the money. This might be more efficient in the sense of lower cost, greater uniformity, and the rest of it. But it also means automatic claim on production instead of a sort of a shuffling, inefficient claim, which I think would have much more disastrous effects. I mean, enormous shift from production to the welfare, to the negative income tax dole. But this is typical of the attitude. Now, for example, Milton Friedman is very proud of the fact that he was one of the people most instrumental in pushing through the withholding tax system in this country. He was working for the U.S. Treasury Department during the war, and came up with this brilliant idea, withholding tax. You see, the problem is, if you didn't have a withholding tax, the whole income tax structure would collapse, because, before the war, it got along fairly well, because taxes were pretty low. But if you're trying to extract 20%, 30%, 70% income tax from a person, and you let them, you say, well, it's due on April 15th, period, the guy's simply not going to diligently save up over the year
and then hand it to the government. It would be a tremendous headache of enforcement, the thing would break down. So Freeman and his colleagues come up with a brilliant idea of extracting it painlessly every day from his paycheck, using, of course, the employer as your unpaid agent in this regard. So this makes the income tax system much more efficient. It allows the growth of an enormous Leviathan state, an enormous income tax burden and criminality, etc. And it's done in the name of efficiency. And in fact, it is more efficient. But when it comes to the state operation, in my view, the less efficiency, the better. It's like talking about the operations of a criminal gang. You don't want them to be efficient. You know exactly where the bank safe is and how to get to go back. You want them to be bumblers like these Italian comedies. As a matter of fact, there's a great story about, I don't know if it's apocryphal or not, but a great story anyway, about Charles F. Kettering, a distinguished free market industrialist. And he was trying to cheer up a friend of his who was in the hospital. And a friend, of course, as Kettering was, were complaining about the growth of government, how terrible it was, and so forth and so on. And finally Kettering said, "Cheer up, Jim. Thank God that we don't get as much government as we pay for." Which I think sums up the question of efficiency. If you gonna have to have the tax burden, et cetera, at least let the money leak out along the way so you don't have an efficient juggernaut coming to oppress you. And this is essentially what the Chicago White position does. The Chicago White is a technician. He's an economic technician. Society, in quote, sets the ends for which he's working. And that means the state, as a so-called representative of society, sets the ends. And a Chicago White is a technical advisor. How do you, something like these Rand Corporation types, are trying to decide where the most efficient place to place the A-bomb or whatever. Where the most efficient pinpoint, how do you fix the state up so it's more efficient in its job of taxing and governing and subsidizing and whatever. And I think that's essentially what the Chicago White position amounts to. Aside from this attitude of efficiency, we have another problem with the Chicago position, which is the original founding father of the Chicago School, Henry C. Simon. I think it's a very instructive assignment for everybody. Go and read Simon's famous book, A Positive Program for Laissez-Faire, which he came out with, I think, in 1934. And because, you see, everybody before him thought the laissez-faire was essentially negative. In other words, you tell the government, leave us alone. And the government is not supposed to do much. And Simon said, no. From my view, the government is out there doing a hell of a lot. It's a positive program. The positive program is essentially three things, I think. One is a very, very drastic egalitarian progressive income tax system. You smash the rich. You take almost, compulsory egalitarianism. You smash the rich and give all the money. You tax the income of everybody above a certain amount, and you pay the money to everybody below a certain amount. Now, we see in this, one of the problems here is that, of course, the Simons and the Chicago School believe that you can do this without affecting incentives at all, aside from the moral problem involved. The guy will still be working to maximize his profit and his income, etc. And then you seize the money from him and give it to somebody else. It's not supposed to affect the matter. These are two sort of different isolated compartments, which we know incidentally now in economics, unfortunately, is micro and macro. You got micro over here where you have free market and supply and demand and all these other goodies. Then you have macro. The government's out there taxing and regulating and putting money and all the rest of it. And the twain never meet. There's never any effect of one of the macro on the micro. And this is one of the problems of Chicagoism. Chicagoism has taken us over from orthodox economics. So you have this very drastic progressive income tax set up. The present Chicago school has happily weakened this. They've given up. They've retreated a great deal from the Simon position. But there's still this trailing clouds of glory that we get from Henry C. Simon. There's still the negative income tax of Freeman is an example of this. You tax everybody above a certain amount, pay out money to those below it. Freeman would not advocate progressive income tax, but this is essentially what it amounts to. It's at least progressive in the sense that the guy below, of course, 2,000 or whatever, is not paying anything. Also, there's various other things that Chicagoites come up with from time to time. For example, the Chicago position now favors local government subsidies to factories. You induce factories to come into the state of the South. Southern rural areas or whatever would like factories to come in there, so it's legitimate for government, local government to subsidize. Then there's another position they came up with, I think Professor Buchanan, who might have shifted over from Chicago Austrianism a year or so ago, but this was in a Chicago incarnation. Buchanan was worried about the external diseconomies again, and the so-called neighborhood effect of crowding and noise and all that, say in Los Angeles. I think he conceived the idea when he was, when he was a visiting professor at UCLA. He began to worry about urban growth and, you know, noise and congestion. Before that, he'd been in Charlottesville, Virginia, where it didn't have much of his problem. And he said, well, let's see, there's three ways to handle this. One is you can enforce property rights. For example, you can enforce the property right against noise invasion of your property or against air pollution against your lungs. And you quickly dismiss that. Well, it's utopian. Dismiss that very quickly. That's out. The second thing you can do, which he really pumped for, is the ideal solution, is to set up a migration barrier in California, not permitting any outlander to move to California from the Middle West or wherever, or set up immigration barriers in New York. Then he sighed and said, well, he admits that's unconstitutional, probably wouldn't be able to amend the Constitution to permit immigration barriers within the country. So for the third best approximation, he pumps for the idea of taxing the people in Chicago, Los Angeles, and New York, and using that money to subsidize Appalachia and other rural areas in order to keep them there so they wouldn't create headaches by migrating to the cities. That's a typical Chicago-like solution. Whatever we may say about it, has nothing to do with free markets. It's pretty clear. There are other examples of this point of view toward taxes and ad hoc solutions. The Friedman position, for example, about both air pollution, water pollution. I don't want to get into technicalities of that, of the whole pollution question here, but the point is that their solution to it is a typical ad hoc utilitarian thing. Well, we decide, meaning the government, of course, we decide how much pollution we want as opposed to how much industrial progress we want, how much we balance the factories as against the lung cancer or whatever, emphysema. We get some kind of a measure of social cost versus social benefit, and then we tax the industries up to the pollution, up to this level. So we make sure that they only pollute, a certain amount and not more than the social benefit outweighing the social cost outweighing the social benefit. But the Austrian position is there's no such thing as social cost and social benefit. There are only individual costs and benefits, which you can't measure one against the other. But at any rate, this is, again, a typical situation. The government sits there on its wisdom and decides its values, which is supposed to represent the public as a whole in some way, some obscure manner, and then this is imposed upon everybody in society through the tax subsidy adjustment. There's also, I thought I mentioned Simons' three great positive functions for government. One of them was to smash everybody making over 5,000 or 10,000, whatever thing is, per year. Another one was extreme, unlimited, fanatical trust busting. So that every corporation above the size of a small blacksmith shop smashed, reduced down to that level, broken up, with extreme. And he was very consistent. He used that against unions also. Unions would be broken up, corporations would be broken up, everybody would be broken up. And this, too, has more or less died out of the Chicago school and other fanatical trust busters they used to be. But in theory, the theory is still there. In other words, the theoretical framework of Chicago economics still says that pure competition, is better than impure, imperfect competition. Imperfect competition means real-world competition. There is no other than imperfect, in quotes. Imperfect is sort of a loaded term. That's part of the whole problem. But at any rate, they still have the theory that pure competition is better than impure. And even though they say, in practice, government is the main source of monopoly, and therefore we have to zero in on repealing government privileges and so on, but still the theory is back there as a canker, no bigger than a man's hand, which once in a while pops out. For example, It wasn't too many years ago when Professor George Stigler, number two man on the Chicago hierarchy, so to speak, advocated before a committee of Congress the breaking up of U.S. Steel as being monopolistic and busted into constituent parts. So every once in a while, the old trust-busting element will pop up in Chicagoism. I'll get to Simon's third sphere of government later, but there's also the Chicago argument for neighborhood effects. This is not only a Chicago argument, this is a general orthodox current economic argument, which is one of the reasons, one of the things I have against Chicago is that essentially they're not too different from regular economics. This is one of the reasons why they're so popular in the economic profession. I mean, one of the reasons why, it's not an act. They favor the free market, except if there are neighborhood effects. In other words, except if anything that you do affects the guy next to you, or affects somebody else in society. Now, of course, this is, from my point of view, this is an open sesame to any kind of intervention, because anything you do affects somebody, somewhere. I mean, if I read Human Action, it benefits, I acquire more wisdom, and it benefits other people who come in contact with me, and therefore, in order to internalize the cost and all that sort of thing, they should be such that they should be taxed to pay me to read Human Action. In other words, you're not capturing, not internalizing the cost, and therefore somebody's got to do it for you. In other words, the government's got to step in and correct the so-called defect in the market. It could be anything. If I'm enjoying the example I used to use in class, which used to be pretty effective before women's lib came around, was miniskirts. Especially old male schools, even more effective. Point being that if you watch and enjoy the sight of girls walking down the street in miniskirts, you're getting a psychic benefit from this. According to Chicago position, you should be taxed to subsidize girls to wear miniskirts because you're not capturing the cost and the benefit. I'm getting a free benefit, so to speak, a free rider in the situation. And this permeates, again, I think it's Friedman himself will limit this argument to two things, basically. One is urban parks. For some reason, very worried about places like Central Park, because if Central Park were private, my God, somebody on Columbus Avenue might look at Central Park and be able to enjoy a leaf of tall trees. And you're not capturing that benefit. You're not making them pay for it. I'm not really concerned with making people pay for stuff. I mean, that's not my shtick. I don't see why this is particularly better. I can see a lot of reasons why it's worse than a free system. If I don't have a membership in Central Park, I'm not an annual member, let's say, in a private park, I might be able to watch the trees, and nobody's going to, unless the Friedman Gestapo will get after me and skewer me for doing it. But I wouldn't be able to be in the park. I'd still be a second-class citizen. I still wouldn't be able to enjoy the park itself. I could only watch the outside. But things of that sort really bother Chicagoites. It makes them pay, sort of thing. If it so happens the free market doesn't make them pay. But he limits it to two things, I say, basically. One is urban parks, because he recognizes that Yellowstone, you can keep people out. You can't enjoy Yellowstone Park very well from out there. But another thing is education, which is, of course, a very big deviation for Friedman, that he favors government subsidy and payment for the education of all kids, not necessarily in public schools, but payment through the tax system, because if one kid is educated, I'm being benefited, he's a better kid. I mean, to put it simply, he's more productive. Well, yeah, if he's more productive, in my view, let him pay for it, or his parents. Or if I fall for the Friedman view, if I fall for the idea of neighborhood effects, which I think is a lot of nonsense anyway, but if I believe it, I can voluntarily subsidize a kid. In free society, I'd be free to do this. But this is not enough for the neighborhood effect position. You have to be forced to quote to subsidize his education. So, but he would limit it. Friedman would essentially limit this to urban parks and education. But as I find anything, you can apply it to anything. You can apply it anywhere else, all the way down the line, to subsidizing miniskirts, to subsidizing anything. Reading newspapers, my God, I read the Times, I benefit, I learn something. So everybody should be taxed to pay me to read it, and so forth and so on. And interestingly enough, if you challenge a Chicagoite with this argument, he will say, yes, and logically you're correct, but, you know, who's going to apply this to this case, which is, I think, interesting commentary on the consistency of the general intellectual standards that are around today's culture.
This is the end of side one. Do not fast forward your cassette. At this point, simply turn the cassette over to play side two.
There's a hole in the sense of the market big enough for a Mack truck to ride into. And those people on the left were smart enough to realize this and, of course, take full advantage of the neighborhood effect gap. Another problem is, I mentioned neighborhood effects. I mentioned negative income tax. I think it would be a total disaster. I hope that and Congress right now is a left-right coalition, a very peculiar story against the Family Assistance Plan, as it's called, essentially the Friedman Plan. Leftists want to go further, and right-wingers don't want to go that far. And this plan this coalition was able to block the thing last year. I don't know if it'll have the same effect this year. Anyway, I foresee a fantastic disincentive effect of enormous proportions. To put it briefly, wherever you set the floor, let's say you set the floor at 2,000, that means that the guy making 2,100 a year becomes to get rather disgruntled and rather edgy by the whole setup. But he is paying taxes to support those lazy bums out of block who are making zero and now getting 2,000 from the government. He's getting nothing from the government. So his smart number and his marginal return over and above the guy on the dole, the guaranteed dole, is $100 per year. He's working 40 hours a week, getting a net return of $100 from his work. I think there's going to be a strong inclination for him to drop out and receive the $2,000. And as he drops out, this is true for people making $2,100, $2,200, $2,800, $3,000, etc., etc. As these guys drop out, this, of course, will add more people on the bill. The cost will go up. The tax cost on the people still working will keep going up. And this will induce more people to leave the working and go on the bill. So you have a fantastic vicious circle. Now, the cost estimates that Friedman and other people have given about how much this thing would amount to per year seem pretty reasonable, $10 billion or whatever it is. Since the budget goes up about $20 billion every year anyway, it's a long way. Why not devote $10 billion to this? But all these cost estimates assume that everybody will keep working with the same intensity and degree as they do now, which of course is a clincher in the whole argument. That's the question-begging clincher. The point is they will not keep working unless they're complete bolts. They will join the automatic goal, the automatic 2000. There will be no stigma attached to it. It's one of the things that the Friedmanites are. And certainly, you got to remove the stigma from being on welfare. Okay, the stigma's removed, everybody gets on it. which, of course, is a real point, which is really forgotten now, because Friedman, the Chicago people consider themselves as heirs of 19th century liberals. They're not, really, because 19th century liberals are much better than that. And the reason why 19th century liberals are in favor of the stigma and crummy workhouses with, feeling is falling down every once in a while, things of that sort. It's precisely because they want to have a strong negative incentive for people not to go on the welfare. And so this was the real point. This has been forgotten in the present so-called free market people. So, and as it happens, the thing snowballs, accelerates, and you increase the taxes and so forth, you know, until finally I think you wind up with conditions of everybody being on the go, nobody working, and then, you know, then the government will be hard put to it to come up with any kind of goods and services to pay out at all to these people. Aside from this, of course, is a problem which everybody realizes, is that $2,000 will not remain $2,000 very long. Immediately political pressures come in, it should be $3,000, because the official poverty level, of course, put out by the Department of Labor is $3,000, that's sort of like a magic figure. It's got to be $3,000, of course, you have to have a 7% cost of living increase every year, so every year prices go up 7%. And then, so the thing sort of escalates, the floor will keep escalating in addition to everything else. So I foresee complete disaster if the negative income tax guarantee income goes through. So that's one big area, clinker area. The free market solution, or the libertarian solution of the welfare question, of course, is that, well, in several steps. One is that free market capitalism is the thing which eliminates poverty, which has brought us up from the cave to the present system, which is the Industrial Revolution and so forth. And secondly, whatever poverty does exist can be aided by voluntary effort, either self-help, short-term programs, or community health programs, or whatever. All of which, since voluntary agencies, for example, do not have the unlimited funds that the state has, all of which will necessarily be based on the idea of helping people help themselves, to get them on their feet, which is again with a 19th century view of private charity, voluntary charity. And of course, also the values of the public, the values of the groups on welfare come in here. There's a charming article, I don't know how many people saw it, the New York Times, I think, about a year ago, about the Albanian population in New York City. I didn't know there were any Albanians in New York City, but there are. And they just set up their first Albanian church anywhere in the world, depending on the church, out in Albania. So the Albanians are very, very poor. There are no wealthy Albanians in New York. There probably no wealthy Albanians anywhere. Anyway, it's certainly not in New York. And Albanians are very poor, and the Albanian spokesman was saying, oh, I know Albanians are welfare, period. It's our kind of very poor group. Well, they said Albanians regard being on welfare as begging on the street, and they refuse to beg, period. And they manage it so they don't get on welfare. So cultural values, social attitudes, etc. also enter the equation. Anyway, going on to the third big sign of the Chicago deviation from the free market, there's the whole money government spending area. Somebody said recently, in an article about a Chicago school, the reason why they didn't become Keynesians is that they were Keynesians before Keynes ever wrote. So they didn't have to, they didn't fall under the sway of the Keynesian Revolution. During the early 1930s, they were considered leftish, radical, socialistic by the Chicago school, by the rest of the profession, because they advocated enormous public works during recessions, inflationary credit, going off the gold standard, and so forth and so on. And these people, these old-line economists, classical economists, were correct. They were socialistic in that sense. But what happened, of course, the rest of the economic profession has moved much more socialistic since then. So they look like free marketeers at this point. But their position still remains basically the same. And that is that the government, the job of the government, first place, is supposed to have, the government is supposed to have absolute control of the monetary system, absolute dictation over money. And the way you get absolute dictation over money is to abolish gold altogether, or silver, or any other commodity, and make money the legal ticket put out by the government, by the Treasury. Now, the Treasury puts out a ticket, the Federal Reserve Board puts out a ticket saying $1 or $10, and make that money and nothing else. So this means that this money is the nub of the market economy. This is the single most important commodity or element in the economy, since money participates in every exchange that you ever make in the system. This means if you allow government to total control of money, you allow government to really total control of the whole system. You've given up before you've even started. And this is what the Chicagoites advocate doing. Chicago's position on money is to cut all even present tenuous. Right now we have a very tenuous and ridiculous but still way there length of international gold. They would cut it completely and have freely fluctuating exchange rates between the dollar and other currencies, which puts the absolute control of the money then completely in the hands of the state without even a balance of payments check. And now, at least once in a while, we have a balance of payments crisis. This puts a limit on government inflation of money. But the Chicago theory would be no limit. The only limit would be Milton Friedman telling them, please don't inflate more than 2-3% per year in the money supply. In other words, Friedman telling, admonishing, heckling, haranguing the Federal Reserve System, if not even inflating too much, not even inflating too little, you should only inflate 3%, 4%, keep changing the figures, with something like 3-4% per year. What is there to force or impel the Federal Reserve System to do this? Nothing, just Friedman. I mean, in other words, you give all power to the federal government, all power over money, and you try to tell them, please limit the inflation, you don't want too much. And I think this is a ridiculous way to proceed, but it's a way, again, which is consistent with the Chicago position of being sort of technical advisors to the state. You give all power to the state, and you advise them technically, no, you shouldn't do that because it's inefficient, messes this thing up here and there. Please don't do that. It's sort of like the advisor of the court of Caligula or whatever. Don't burn this city because it's, you know, reducing the gross national product or whatever the advice is. It's not going to be very effective, my prediction. Since the theme is interested in social prediction, sort of the key to truth, my prediction is not going to work. and it hasn't. The reason why Friedman wants a 2-3% per year inflation, that's going to be rather technical, I don't want to get into that, but basically it's the old Chicago finance position of stabilizing the price level. The price level should remain constant. This became sort of a mystical idea, literally, of the Chicago school. Somehow a constant price level is the thing that means that money is performing its measuring function and so forth and so on. Suffice it to say on this, on a truly free market, unhampered by government inflation and government banking and government money, prices generally tend to fall considerably. As the supply of goods and services and productivity increases, prices fall, just like the price of TV sets has fallen from $2,000 for a crummy set to 20 years ago, to, you know, $60 or $100 for a very good set now. This is generally what happens with prices on a free market. For some reason, Chicago people hate this idea, and they want the government to step in to keep the force of price level to remain constant at all times. And this leads them to this idea of 3% inflation of money supplies to balance the increase of goods and services, etc. There's also a difference in business cycle theory, but I don't, again, get a little technical and go into that. Again, I just want to say that there's a bit of confusion among some people because both Friedman and the Austrians agree that the Federal Reserve System was responsible for the 1929 Depression. So it's considered that they really agree basically on the whole problem. They don't. It's completely the opposite. In other words, the Austrian view is that the 1929 Depression was brought about by Federal Reserve Board expansion of the money supply during the 1920s and even later, which brought about a situation which, you know, caused a depression. In other words, monetary inflation by the Federal Reserve System bringing about an inevitable recession, a depression. The Friedman position is that the Federal Reserve Board didn't inflate enough, that they held back to the proper level of enormous inflation to offset falling prices, etc. So the Friedman position and the Austrian position is exactly the opposite. Both zero in on their own Federal Reserve System, that's true. But each one has a completely different view. The Chicago position is that they should have inflated more. The Austrian position is they shouldn't have inflated at all. A slight difference. I think that more or less sums up at least the political economy distinction and all sorts of methodological and philosophical critiques that they make of Chicago school. I think they're in a sense worse philosophically than they are even in politics. That's a whole other realm. The two things, of course, again, lap over, as I try to say, that theory of property and justice and so forth. To sum it up, I think what the problem is, the free market, in quotes, which would exist under the Chicago system, would be only under the sufferance of the central government and its advisors, technical advisors. If they thought for 1 minute, at any point, that the free market was, quote, not efficient, unquote, in relation to some other scheme, they would abandon it and abolish it. On the Chicago scene, therefore, we have no defense against state oppression whatsoever. Thank you.
Dr. Rothrock will be taking a few questions.
Yeah.
What would you term as the distinguishing characteristics of the Austrian school? You referred to as Hayek. You included Hayek in the Austrian school. You include such men as Robbins,
Patrick. Yeah. It's a complex situation. Robbins was before something like 1938. It's difficult to sum it up in one minute. I would simply say the Austrian doctrine, the Austrian approach, starts with the individual. In other words, starts with this methodological individualism. Starts with the individual, analyzes his actions from a formal, logical point of view, and then deduces the implications of this. In other words, it's a logical theory starting with certain basic self-evident axioms and building on that an enormous structure of propositions which are true because the axiom is true and the logic is correct. The Chicago position is completely different. It deals with aggregates, with groups, with statistical correlations, and so forth.
I
haven't heard it either.
It's
a development only on top of the early Austrian school. For one thing, the early Austrian school never really applied Austrianism to money, which was one of Mises' great accomplishments, was to apply it to money, apply margin utility theory to money, and so forth. But also, the early Austrians had no theory of business cycle. Didn't integrate money, capital theory, and business cycle theory in one big edifice. And also, the Austrians were not pure laissez-faireists at all. They were generally free market, but they weren't really interested in the political application of the theory, the intervention, and so forth, which Mises and Hayek have been. So that's, I think, the basic distinction. So Hayek, I didn't endorse all of Hayek's views at all. But Hayek, for example, is a big rule of law fan, which is getting all sorts of problems. He says that the key thing about any law, the thing that makes it good, in essence, is that it be uniform, predictable. Predictable and uniformly applied to everybody and written down. That's the criterion. Well, my position on that is that, supposing there's a law saying everybody at age 25 should be, tortured for 20 days for the good of the whatever, Muhammad, or whatever you want to call it. That'd be completely predictable and completely certain and apply to everybody, male, female, 4F, or whatever. And I have no argument against it. See, that's, I think, the problem with the rule of law business. Yeah.
Maybe it was two. Great idea that they achieved independently did not originate the idea. The ancient Romans used it to assess property during one of the regimes.
Okay, very good. Did they originate it independently, at least? Or they, they realized it was the ancient Romans?
Could you or would you locate Louis Celso on the spectrum between the Austrian and the
I couldn't.
I was a little sorry to see that you seem so angry at Chicago.
Well, I wouldn't say angry. Maybe bitter was more of a...
In the city, wouldn't you agree with the statement that the difference between Milton Friedman, one difference between Milton Friedman's position, say, at the point you were called with Stanley, is that the Coghlan School agrees that the high standard of living we have now is a result of free market forces. Whereas people like Orbeez and Stanley, and I'm actually, tell me if I'm right, believe that it's a result of union activity and government regulation.
Well, I think you have to separate things like Goldberg from Samuelson. Samuelson is definitely in the mainstream of economists. Goldberg business. Goldberg is considered kind of a nut. And Samuelson is much more sophisticated than that. I mean, I think Samuelson, I don't think there's really too much difference between Samuelson and Friedman, really. I mean, obviously, a certain specific thing. See, I think the Chicago people have done a very good job in certain specific empirical articles. You know, for example, investigating how could a radio TV system be privately owned, which they have done. How could water be privately owned? They've done a very good job on a specific task, or how the ICC messing up the railroad system. So if you assign them a specific task, they often do pretty well, especially when it deals with government regulation, you know, specific regulation. But you can't trust them, you know, so the larger matters. That's the point. I mean, I'm not saying they're using the stuff that they've done, which has been good, you know. But in overall, in a macro sense, so to speak, it's not so much different. You see the debate between Friedman and Heller, or Friedman and Samuelson on television about what to do in the present situation or whatever. There's not too much difference between them.
What about labor
unions? Now, you see, what's happening about labor unions, it's very interesting about labor unions. I'm glad you asked it, because what's happening about labor unions is there's sort of a left-right consensus within the profession that they're pretty crummy. In other words, the old liberals, Samuelson type, let's say, are not really too pro-union anymore. They've sort of given up a little bit. First of all, all economists now acknowledge that unions do not raise the wage rates, the overall wage rates. That's generally acknowledged. Also, it's generally acknowledged, which the Chicago people pioneered in, I have to grant that. Generally acknowledged, during the inflation, union wage rates lag behind non-union wage rates because collective bargaining is essentially a pain in the neck. It's a slowing down process. It's a gear in the machine. It's a fan in the gears, you know. So as a result of this, non-union wage rates will tend to go up smoothly and quickly during inflation. And union wage rates will tend to go up in a sort of a staggered, stepwise fashion. They tend to lag behind. The other hand, during a recession, you have a real problem because union wage rates fall less rapidly than non-union wage rates. But during inflation, which is what we generally have now, of course, too, unions don't have much economic power. Their power is specific in certain areas, you know, like the glass blowers or something like that, with local booming trades that have a local, which is a localized field. But you can get a monopoly of a field and restrict entry of other groups and, you know, non-relatives. I mean, for example, well, you can't be an electrician in Hoboken unless you're the son, not even nephew of a current electrician. You have to be the son of an electrician to get in, existing electrician. I mean, and then they can raise the wage rates a bit, but the point is that overall, unions haven't got much economic power, it's generally admitted. On the other hand, the Friedman position sort of, because of this, the old-fashioned position where you have to smash unions because they're getting all this power, the old-fashioned conservative position. The Friedman people say, well, they don't really have that much power, then why worry about them? So there's been a sort of a coming together on unions, of the liberals and conservatives. They both sort of dismiss them as being fairly unimportant and a pain in the neck, but not too important. Yeah.
Are you still focused on fracturing the river banking? And if so, how would you enforce it under an anarchal capitalist
situation? Yeah, I'm still focused on fracturing the river banking. It's fraud. I mean, if it's can prove to me it's not fraud, I wouldn't be against it. Fraud meaning a situation where you say that you have the money on hand to redeem somebody's property. I consider fractional reserve banking as the equivalent of a warehouse which we deposit your furniture for the summer or something, and the guy takes the furniture in the meantime and rents it out. Now, I mean, this is illegal. I mean, it's an embezzlement, or whatever you want to call it, conversion is a legal term. And you zap it, you know. So I consider fractional reserve banking the equivalent of that. Now, there are ways. See, one thing is that the fractional reservists claim that, well, people really know down deep that they're lending the money for a certain period of time to the bank. Well, in that case, let them say so. Well, for example, they have certificates of deposit of banks, perfectly admirable institution. You know, you say, all right, you can borrow $1 million from General Motors, the bank will borrow it for 6 months or 9 months, and that's it. Fine. No call of that at all. In fact, I'd like to see, you know, loans being conducted that way instead of the fractional reserve technique. Up over there.
Murray, I really can't resist pointing out what seems 12 important points and two incredible ones. The first one is not to take not for us, but the first one is called impact. I've stated any number of times in personal context that we did that, of course, during the war and since the rest of it. Point two, Frank Knight and not Henry Simon. Three, I don't know any dog-oriented comic papers of progressive newsmanship or any new compulsory egalitarianism that Simon did there. Four, he cited as one particular example of somebody to encourage factories moving to the south.
Cut his list down and maybe get to the more credible
one. Can you cut your list a little bit? I mean, it's hard to answer 14 at once.
Could you pick out one or two of the most important ones, please? Don't mean to try to cut it down too much, but you've made several points, and I'd like Dr. Rothrock to answer a few of them and then perhaps go on to another question.
These are all incredible points.
Well, let him handle a few of them.
First place, two, no question about the fact that Frank Knight was the co-founder of Chicago School of Law and Henry Simon. However, Frank Knight was not the really political, the hard-nosed political theorist of the group, which was really Simon. Although Knight did have several reviews and articles in which he viciously attacked Mises and even poor Hayek for being anarchists, end quote. In other words, Knight's sense of the free market is pretty darn limited. And Simon, of course, is even worse. But Simon was really the political hammer arm of Chicago, the early Chicago school. I didn't say that people believe now at the progressive income tax. I thought specifically that Simon advocated it, but the negative income tax is sort of a holdover of it in the sense that people below a certain income get paid and other people pay for it. It's progressive in that sense, and only in that sense. It's enough, I think, but anyway. I'm not saying that they want to tax the rich more than the people making over $6,000 a year, but it will be progressive in relation to people making under $3,000 or whatever the floor would be. I think this is the point, money supply and price level, the point I was trying to make was, that sure, Friedman wants to limit the inflation to 2-3%, whatever the figure is. I call that inflationary, by the way. It has business cycle effects, which is another story I don't want to get into at this point. It has a boom-bust effect. But aside from that, the whole point is that first Friedman would grant the absolute power of the Federal Reserve System to manipulate the money supply. Then you ask them, there's a limit of 2-3% a year. They don't have to listen to them. That's the point. First, you centralize the power, give everybody the big gun, so to speak. You give the Federal Reserve System the absolute power to control their life, and you tell them, please limit it to 2-3%. I'm saying they're not going to limit it. But the interesting point I was really interested in your statement was your question about the wage earning lobby versus the welfare lobby. That's an interesting point because I think it betrays an ignorance of the way political power really is exercised and the way pressure groups operate. The whole point is the thing is there wouldn't be any tariff on, there wouldn't be any quotas on textile why are there import quotas on pet dogs? I mean, if you pull the average person, there are a lot more, millions more, of course, consumers of pet dogs than there are pet dog manufacturers. And yet the pet dog manufacturers are able to lobby for themselves an outrageous imposition of import quotas in order to restrict production and raise the price. How are they able to do it? They're able to do it for various reasons. One is because they're full-timers at it. They're professionals. Their whole life is wrapped up in the textile business. My whole life is not wrapped up in the textile business. Neither are any of your life, which wrapped up. So therefore, they can maneuver for themselves a special privilege in Congress. This is what's normally the so-called representative of the public is supposed to have. It's represented with special interests are down there all the time. And it's their rational interest in quotes to do this because they're full-timers. Their whole life and assets are at stake. But for a consumer, all right, the price of clothes is up, $10 a suit or something. I'm not going to go to the ballot case for that individual $10. And so there's a built-in, any kind of a state system, any kind of artist, quote, limited government, unquote, system, there's a built-in bias in favor of special privilege and galloping statism and collectivism for that reason. And you will see, my friend, if we do get a negative income tax, the welfare lobby will be a lot more important than whatever the poor mass of taxpayers have to pay for this. Unfortunately, this is what happened before. What's going to happen again? Somebody else, I hope, huh? Over there.
Would you please comment on the following statements from Libertarian Analysis? The intervention of state capitalist economy.
Is this my article, Libertarian Analysis?
No, it's
previous
next.
Okay.
Profits do tend to be an index of exploitation of the rest of society, since they are usually derived from the use of state surplus. Do you agree with that? And if so, why or why not?
I think in some cases it's obviously true, in other cases it isn't. I don't think there's a general rule. The rule of profits in the present system are the index of exploitation. I think it's pretty obvious the general dynamics profits are an index of their exploitation. It's not true that, if we make a profit here at this meeting, for example, we're not being an example of exploitation. So I don't think you can make a general rule on that. So I would disagree with the statement of the general rule, if it's meant that way.
Thank you, Dr. Wilson.